Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this day before Thanksgiving, the 21st of November. This hour, we're going to be talking about something that has been picked up by the Barack Obama camp. It has also been picked up by David Broder in his commentary on Sunday, November 18, that really comes from a book that was published a few months ago that is titled Her Way, The Hopes and Ambitions of Hillary Rodham Clinton. Don Van Natta is the author of that book, and he is our guest this hour. Broder's column on Sunday prompted this conversation. What of a dual presidency if Hillary Clinton wins? He calls this a largely unspoken issue, the two-headed campaign and the prospect of a dual presidency. There is nothing in American constitutional or political theory to account for the role of a former president, still energetic and alive and full of ideas, occupying the White House with the current president. It is an unusual thing to think about. No president exists for such an arrangement, and ground rules have been written. The Obama camp is unveiling a new line of criticism against Hillary that comes probably directly from Van Natta's book. He is talking about the Clintons secretly formulating a 20-year plan to deliver the presidency first to Bill and then to Hillary. We're going to talk about all of this hour. There's also some breaking news with Scott McClellan's book, and we'll ask our guest about that a little bit later during this conversation. Don Van Natta is our guest. He is the co-author of Her Way, The Hopes and Ambitions of Hillary Rodham Clinton. He is an investigative correspondent at the New York Times, where he was a member of two Pulitzer Prize-winning teams. He won, as member of a six-reporter team, the 1999 Pulitzer in National Reporting for a series of stories about American corporations that sold satellite technology with defense uses to China. He has been posted overseas. He was based in the newspaper's London Bureau for nearly 3 years, while at the Times he has covered the impeachment of Bill Clinton, the 2000 election in Florida, campaign finance. Since September 11, 2001, he's covered terrorism and extraordinary rendition. He worked for 8 years before joining the Times for the Miami Herald, where he was a member of a team of reporters awarded the 1993 Pulitzer Prize for Public Service for coverage of Hurricane Andrew in August of 1992. We are going to have a lot of phone calls on this subject. Coupled this with the information that Obama's going up in the polls in Iowa, and here is the phone number. Join us when you'd like. Let us talk for a little while, and then we'll have you be a part of the conversation. Our number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050. 414-227-2050. And if you'd like to send an email, that address is talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. Hi, Don. Thank you so much for being with us.
Good morning, Kathleen. It's great to be with you today.
We have an awful lot to talk about. What about this pact? Is this was in your book, and it's coming up all over the place now that the Clintons formulated this 20-year plan. First he got the presidency, then she got the presidency.
That's right. We report in our book that before Bill and Hillary Clinton took their marriage vows back in the 70s, they exchanged their political vows. This is in the mid-70s when they were both living in Arkansas before they got married. They set out to what Bill Clinton himself called a 20-year project to remake the Democratic Party. This was shortly after George McGovern got trounced by Richard Nixon in 1972. So they wanted to remake the Democratic Party within two decades and make Bill Clinton president of the United States. And as we all know, they accomplished that goal. But then after Bill Clinton became president, in 1993, in the summer of 1993, he told a friend of his that his plan was to serve as two terms as president. Not a surprise, every president wants to serve two terms. But then after that, he and Hillary were going to set out to make her a two-term president. And we reported this in our book, Her Way, which was published in June. And just recently, just within the last several days, Barack Obama has picked up on this report, and it's now getting quite a bit of buzz and being talked about quite a bit around.
And he's obviously picking up on it because the American people wouldn't feel entirely comfortable with that arrangement.
That's right. He's using it as a line of attack. He is, as everyone who's followed the campaign knows, has intensified his attacks against Senator Clinton in recent weeks, and this is another new line of attack that he adopted over the weekend.
And it seems to be serving him well. He's now the front runner in Iowa.
Yes, that's right. He is now at in the most recent poll at 30% in Iowa of likely caucus goers, and Hillary Clinton is at 26%, and John Edwards is at 22%, and Governor Richardson is at 11%. And yes, he's finally gone in the lead. Although the margin of error is 4.5 points in that poll, so it really is, as it's been for months, mm-hmm. a statistical dead heat between Obama, Clinton, and Edwards.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting that he still is this incredibly magnetic guy, and as he goes around the country doing campaigning for her, the whole thing is so very well coordinated. He's pulling in a lot of money. He's asking people to come to my house and have chips with me and watch Hillary on the debate. I mean, it's all very – people love the guy, and somehow he's figuring into this campaign in a way that I'm not exactly sure of. What is it?
Well, you're absolutely right. Bill Clinton is the most popular – Democrat among Democrats. He's the most popular American with a lot of Democrats, and some of that charisma and some of that magnetism that you talk about has certainly lent itself well to Hillary Clinton's campaign. There are probably some Democrats who, if they gave you a really honest answer, would say a vote for Hillary Clinton would be, in a way, a vote for Bill Clinton's third term in the White House.
Hmm.
That's how popular he is. And the Clinton campaign has been very smart in the way they've used Bill Clinton. They've not used him so much that he overshadows Senator Clinton at these campaign events in Iowa and New Hampshire, but at the same time, using him in these videos, that Sopranos final episode spoof that they did where Senator Clinton told the former president to eat his carrots and not onion rings, sort of subtly showing who was in charge. All of these things have really, I think, connected with a lot of voters, and they're using him really as a terrific weapon in blunting some of the criticism that Senator Obama and Senator Edwards have leveled, and also as a way to remind people that the 90s, and especially Democrats, that the 90s when Bill Clinton was president was a time that people look back on quite fondly these days.
Mm-hmm. So you put a former president in the White House, and she's been somewhat vague about what she would do, that he would be this roving ambassador. But it is a question that people will ask, and there isn't any There isn't any precedent for this. You got a former president who's been wildly popular, who was the subject of a long, drawn-out scandal that we don't want to go through again, for heaven's sake. That would be awful. What does he do? He's the guy who's magnetic. He's the guy who's got a lot of ideas. He's young. He's energetic. He's got all these plans going. Do we need to know, are voters asking that, what's the guy's role should she win?
Well, voters have asked that, and I think voters are quite curious about that. And Senator Clinton has repeatedly said that she would put Bill Clinton to work, but outside the West Wing. She would put him on the road and make him this, as you point out, this roving global ambassador to travel around the world, which is primarily what he's doing in his post-presidential years. He's constantly on the road traveling everywhere, especially to Africa on behalf of the Clinton Global Initiative and his philanthropic activities. But what she would do is she would enlist him to really try, as she puts it, to repair America's reputation around the world that she says has been damaged greatly during the Bush administration. And again, I think that's a very smart answer to a potentially difficult and thorny question for voters about what exactly is Bill Clinton going to be doing during a Hillary Clinton administration.
Right. Would you say that it's safe to characterize him, as I've heard him characterized, as much more centrist than she is?
That's a very good question, Kathleen. I think there is some truth to that. It is often said as a criticism of Hillary Clinton that she is not as much of a centrist and somebody who will compromise and negotiate compromise and find a sort of middle ground than Bill Clinton was. I'm not so sure that's fair, because Senator Clinton, in her time in the Senate, has really gone out of her way to reach across the aisle on a number of initiatives with Republicans, and has really taken a lot of steps that would be described as a sort of a centrist in the Senate. So, but it really remains to be seen. I think people suspect that Senator Clinton, because of their own sort of preconceived notions about her and that she's so polarizing, they suspect that she's making moves to sort of project that she's a centrist now to get elected, but then after being elected would not be as much of a centrist as he would be. And quite frankly, we really don't know. It's something that we're going to just have to wait and see. I do think there's some evidence that shows that she's more of a centrist than people give her credit for, though she does have a core set of beliefs, and those are more on the liberal side of the political ledger. And so I really think it remains to be seen just what kind of a president she would be if she's elected.
Right. An exception, of course, would be the 2002 vote to support the invasion of Iraq and her vocal support of the idea that Hussein supported al-Qaeda, and then her change that she would end this war. She's anti-war without saying that she made a mistake in 2002. Let's talk a little bit about that. It's a focus of some of your book.
It is. It's a big focus of our book. About half of our book deals with Senator Clinton's time in the Senate, and she herself called that vote in 2002 for the resolution to give President Bush the authority to invade Iraq as the most important decision of her life. Hmm. And we report in the book for the first time that Senator Clinton did not read the national intelligence estimate. This was the intelligence summary of whether Iraq possessed weapons of mass destruction or not. It was made available to all 100 senators, and Senator Clinton did not read it prior to making that vote. And if she had read it, she may not have gone on the Senate floor as she did and said there was a direct link between Saddam Hussein and al-Qaeda. That document that was made available to her raised major questions about any link. Remember, President Bush and Vice President Cheney were making that argument that there was a link between Saddam Hussein and al-Qaeda, and a majority of Americans believed there was a link based on their word, but this document that Senator Clinton failed to read raised major questions about it. One of her colleagues, Senator Bob Graham of Florida, read the document. He voted against the resolution. He implored his colleagues, including Senator Clinton, just 2 days before that historic vote, to read the National Intelligence Estimate, and Senator Clinton still didn't do it. And it's perplexing for me, as one of her biographers, of why this woman who is so well-prepared, does her homework, works so hard, would not read that document prior to making the vote that she herself calls the most important decision of her life. And as we report in the book, there were people around her telling us that she had already had an eye at running for the presidency in 2002. She knew that the Iraq war was popular with the majority of Americans. To prove her military strength and her toughness and her mettle to be commander-in-chief, that was part of what was in her calculation in that vote. And when you look at it through that prism, it perhaps makes more sense. The other thing, Kathleen, that you point out is that her evolution on that, being somebody who was so hawkish in her comments on the Senate floor when she voted for the Iraq War resolution, and now the evolution from that to where she is today as a sort of anti-war, let's get the troops home as quickly as possible, without admitting that that her vote itself was a mistake, is what we detail in the book, and that evolution is really fascinating and gives you a glimpse into Senator Clinton's character and her leadership.
I think that Kucinich at the last debate was the only one who said, when asked about this very issue, that he read the report, which is a direct slam at her. I'm wondering why the other candidates, considering the fact that the American public is very upset about this war and that she was vulnerable a while ago on her vote on this, why they don't take this issue and just hammer her with it.
I've been a bit surprised by that myself. Senator Edwards has done that. He hasn't done it in a very forceful way in any of the debates, but he has done it on the campaign trail, particularly in Iowa, and does get into some of this detail. But of course, he admitted that he also voted for the Iraq War resolution. He admitted that it was a mistake, and he has criticized Senator Clinton for not saying it was a mistake. that her vote was a mistake. But Senator Obama has been largely silent on this. He will say, I was opposed to the war and Senator Clinton was not, but he doesn't always get into a lot of the details of that, and quite frankly, that has surprised me. Kathleen, I want to tell your listeners one other thing that's quite interesting that we report in the book, and that is Senator Clinton, in her evolution that I talked about when she retreated from that war vote in 2004, 2005, and more recently, the last couple of years, has always said that she believed that her vote was a vote for diplomacy, that in giving President Bush the authority to invade Iraq, that she believed he was going to allow the inspectors to continue to do their work, and that was what she believed, and that she was misled by President Bush. Well, the record contradicts that point that Senator Clinton repeatedly makes. The record, as we report in our book, shows that there was another vote that was not widely noticed by the press at the time. It was an amendment proposed by Senator Carl Levin of Michigan. And in that that amendment basically said this: the Senate will give President Bush the authority to go to war only if he pursues diplomacy. And if he does not pursue diplomacy to the satisfaction of the Senate, they would rescind it. In other words, it was a sort of trust but verify amendment that the Senate voted on. And Senator Clinton voted against the Levin amendment. So when she had a chance in real time to actually hold President Bush's feet to the fire on his promise to pursue diplomacy, she voted against it. So it directly contradicts this argument that she's been making and continues to make on the campaign trail, that she wanted diplomacy at the time she voted for the Iraq war resolution.
Let's talk about the gender issue for a moment here, Don. Do you think that the fact that she is female has to make her more of a hawk on all of these issues so that we can think of a woman as commander-in-chief? Because after all, this is new.
It is new, and there were people around her that we spoke to for this book, Democratic strategists and people who were advising her, who said that that has certainly been part of the calculation of Senator Clinton in this time of this so-called war on terrorism, and we're at war in Iraq, that she really had to establish her national security credentials. She had to prove she could be, because she's attempting to be the first woman president of the United States, she had to prove that she was tough enough to be commander-in-chief. And we heard that in our reporting for the book repeatedly, and I certainly believe, and I think we establish it pretty convincingly in the book, that this is a motive to a lot of what she's done in the national security arena.
We're going to welcome phone calls, and here is our phone number, 800-486-8655. Don Van Natta is our guest, investigative reporter with the New York Times, co-author of Her Way, The Hopes and Ambitions of Hillary Rodham Clinton. It was reported in their book, which came out a few months ago, that the Clintons had formulated a 20-year plan to deliver the presidency first to Bill and then to Hillary. That has now been brought up by Barack Obama, who is using that as a line of criticism against Hillary. And it also looks at, you know, we're looking at this duo here. If she should be elected president, what role does he have? It's uncharted territory here. Gentleman who was president for 8 years, and now he's the husband of a woman who could be president. What role are we worried about that at all? What do you think about Barack Obama's using this as a criticism here of Hillary Clinton? And we're looking at her plans for her life and when they were formulated, and whether or not she is genuine on a lot of issues, how she could have made some mistakes, which, as Don said, she is just so meticulous about the way she has run this campaign, so meticulous. She has done her homework. She doesn't make mistakes. How could she reinvent herself as an anti-war presidential candidate, and is that sticking? All right, one line is open. It won't be for long. 800-486-8655-227-2050 if you're joining us in Milwaukee. If you'd like to send an email, you can do that. talk@wpr.org is our email address, talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up the second hour of our program today, what I think is a true Thanksgiving story. I was touched, and I'm sure many of you were as well, by the Sandra Day O'Connor story that was brought to national attention by Mr. and Mrs. O'Connor's son in an interview in Arizona. He has Alzheimer's. She, as you know, left the Supreme Court to care for him. And he has, I don't know if you could say fallen in love, but he has companionship with a woman who's at the facility, the assisted living facility where he is right now. And so you have the situation where he probably doesn't remember her. He's attached to another woman, his girlfriend, and she is so generous of heart that she visits them and she's happy that he's able to make this kind of connection. I just think it's quite a story. We're going to be talking about love and old age. We'll be looking at this need for human connection. We'll have two guests with us, a professor of neurology, pharmacology, and toxicology, and director of the Dementia Research Center at the Medical College of Wisconsin, and also the director of the Center on Age and Community. And we'll be looking at all of this the second hour of our show. All right, let's hop to phone calls for Don Van Natta, investigative reporter with the New York Times, co-author of Her Way, The Hopes and Ambitions of Hillary Rodham Clinton. And our first call comes from Salt Lake City. Jim is calling us. Hi, Jim.
Hi. Hey, I guess what concerns me most, rather than the two-person presidency that you were discussing, is the two-family presidency with Bush and Clinton. And I just want to say I voted for President Clinton, so it's nothing, it's so much the policy as I feel that we're just getting all those special interest groups behind two families, and before you know it, in 8 years, Jeb Bush will be coming. and seriously.
Yeah, I know what you're saying.
And, you know, we're becoming like a third world country, whether it's in Asia or Central America, where two families monopolize the two political parties. And that really concerns me more than anything.
Don.
Jim, I think that's a great point, and I think that that was one of the things that Senator Obama was attempting to stress in picking up this 20-year plan. If Senator Clinton is elected president and she serves two terms, we will have 28 consecutive years of either a Bush or a Clinton as president.
Isn't that something?
And it really is something that has that troubles some voters. It's also something that has been recognized as a line of attack against Senator Clinton. Some of her strategists told my co-author and myself during our reporting that 28 consecutive years, that dynasty question of either a Bush or a Clinton in the White House, really is going to be a high hurdle for Senator Clinton to overcome if she is the nominee in a general election. And so it's been recognized even by her people that how can she actually say that she is sort of the candidate of change when by the nature of her candidacy, she's already said, well, my husband and I, we did these things in the 90s in the White House, and Senator Obama recognizes this, and as does Senator Edwards, and they are on the campaign trail constantly portraying Senator Clinton as a creature of Washington, a creature of special interests. Senator Edwards does this quite a bit, and that she is not the true agent of change that the country is looking for. And as we're seeing in the polls, the most recent poll in Iowa, I think some of those arguments are gaining traction.
Yeah, and by a long shot they are. Are we making too much of that? When people were polled, they said that they really were looking much more at change. It was much more important to them than experience was.
I was really struck by that too, Kathleen. By almost 2-1, people were saying that they want change more than experience. And that's bad news for Senator Clinton, because she has, from the beginning of her campaign in January, has portrayed herself as the experienced candidate and the tough candidate. And it seems in this most recent poll that those qualities are less important than a candidate who can truly represent change. And so getting to Jim's point, I think that there are a number of people around the country who feel that way. And as I say, I really think it's going to be a tough hurdle for Senator Clinton to overcome, not just in the primaries. I mean, if she gets through the primaries, but in a general election.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much, Jim, for the call. We go to Marilyn next from Washburn. Hi, Marilyn.
Oh, good morning. You may have responded in part to my comments already, or just now. I was a little disturbed to think that you were casting an ominous specter on the fact that anyone would plan to be a president. Now, I believe, 20 years is a long time, but I could see if it were through illegal means, as this administration has done. But I hope we're not descending to the point where we're just looking for something to pick at rather than actual behavior and performance.
So you're not, you wouldn't be troubled by that, the fact that the Clintons would be in the White House for a long period of time, the Bushes have been in a long time.
No, because I guess I see them as individuals.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly the experience is great. And now, mind you, I haven't made up my mind yet who I like. But I think the Democrats are plagued with an embarrassment of riches and they're great candidates.
Mm-hmm.
And I think some people are pretty desperate to find fault. And they're having a tough time.
Done.
Yeah, let me address that, because I've heard similar comments since our book has been published, that, you know, we are suggesting by reporting that there was a 20-year plan created back in the 70s that there's something wrong with that, or there's something sinister in that. And not at all do we portray it that way in the book. And I want to be clear that there's nothing wrong. Every single person running for president is ambitious. There's nothing wrong with that. We found it interesting and revealing because in Hillary Clinton's own book, her autobiography, Living History, she barely describes a single ambitious impulse in her public life. All of her impulses are because she wants to do good for her fellow citizens, and she just doesn't talk about ambition. It's something entirely missing in her own description of her life and of herself, and I found that sort of striking. So when we learned that Bill and Hillary, before they even got married, were you know, and when people, before they get married, they're making plans if they're getting ready to get married for their lives, for a home they may own, for maybe children. These folks were talking about remaking the Democratic Party and making Bill Clinton president. We just found that revealing, and there's no judgment at all about that. And the fact that in 1993, at a time when Bill Clinton had appointed his wife, Hillary, who was then the first lady, to be in charge of this incredibly ambitious project to remake the healthcare system in the United States, tells a friend that he wants to be a two-term president. And after that, their hope is to make Hillary a two-term president. We just found it revealing, and really no value judgment about that, other than the fact it's revealing and tells us something new about the two of them.
So, as you looked at her earlier life, you wouldn't make anything of the fact that he held her back, that she could have been president before he became president if she hadn't met him.
Oh,
and,
no,
and was thinking
well,
about
we do
that.
In the book. We report, in fact, that Betsy Wright, who Kathleen, I'm sure your listeners
sure.
know, was instrumental in helping get Bill Clinton elected president in 1992. Betsy Wright met both Bill and Hillary back in 1972 when they were, all three of them were working on the McGovern for President campaign, and they were working in Austin, Texas. And at that time, Betsy Wright was convinced that Hillary was the true star between Bill and Hillary and the true future president, not Bill Clinton, but Hillary Rodham. And she said to me in an email exchange, and we publish it in this book, that when Hillary decided to leave the Northeast and go to Arkansas and marry Bill Clinton, Betsy Wright said her dream of Hillary ever becoming the first woman president died. She felt that Hillary was really hurting her chances to ever be a president by hitching her wagon to Bill Clinton.
But
isn't it ironic that now the fact that she was first lady for 8 years and she's now the junior senator from New York and
right.
Bill Clinton's the former president and he's helping her possibly realize that dream. It's really a very revealing comment Betsy Wright made.
It's an amazing story. But what about Hillary? Did she have thoughts in that regard back in 1972 or not?
Well, not that she admits to in her book, and the folks that we talked to from that period say no, she certainly wanted to thought about getting into politics as early as 1980 after Bill Clinton lost re-election as governor in Arkansas. Hillary herself thought about running for governor in Arkansas, so she's entertained thoughts about running for office as early as 1980. But back in the 70s, she was working on women's rights issues, on children's issues. She was a lawyer and a partner in the Rose Law Firm, as it was a corporate lawyer when she was First Lady of Arkansas. And so, no, she did not seem to be making moves at that time, that early in her life, to get on a political path.
Thanks very much for the call. Mohammed from Madison is next. Hi, Mohammed.
Hi, Kathleen. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Good show, good guests, and good questions. I was going to ask whether the gentleman thought Hillary Clinton was being politically savvy or deceptive when she was running for Senate, and since she's been a senator before her announcement, whether she planned to run for president, and she never would answer it or would fend it off. But based on his, he sort of answered that already. I think he makes them sound almost premeditated. But I have a medical problem that keeps me up at nights, and I was listening to the BBC the other night, and they mentioned something about Hillary Clinton or her campaign letting out, saying that they had something on Barack Obama. I looked for it in the newspaper the next day. I couldn't find it. I finally found it on the Internet, and who pops up but Bob Novak and Rush Limbaugh.
All right.
And I'm wondering whether your guest has a perspective on that or knows whether, you know, where that might have come from or if there's anything to it.
Well, Muhammad, it was first reported by Bob Novak that the Obama campaign, the Clinton campaign had some scandalous information about Barack Obama that it was considering making public, but that it might not. Senator Obama immediately sort of pounced on that report and challenged the Clinton campaign. Well, if they had something, you know, make it public. And the Clinton campaign swore that they had nothing, that the report was inaccurate, that it was false, and that's pretty much, you know, where it was left. Howard Wolfson, the communications director for Senator Clinton, suggested that this was an attempt by Bob Novak or one of Bob Novak's sources to simply start a fight between the two leading Democratic candidates, and the suggestion was maybe it was a dirty trick by some Republican source of Bob Novak's to get Senator Clinton and Senator Obama fighting over kind of a non-issue. But that's really the extent of it, and that's all I really know about it, quite frankly. I've not personally investigated it.
What is there to know about it? It's a story about that we don't know what the story is.
That's right. It's a story about we don't know what the story is. It's really kind of a non-story, and it really, I think it only lasted about 24 hours or at the most 48 hours. And Mohammed, the reason you saw nothing about it in the paper, I think there was very little written about it and through the sort of the prism of whether or not Bob Novak had been sort of used by a Republican source or not. But it really ended there.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Muhammad, for your call. Lines are open if you want to join the conversation. Here's how you reach us, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. A good political conversation as you're heading to where you're going for this Thanksgiving with Don Van Natta. He's an investigative reporter for the New York Times and co-author of Her Way, The Hopes and Ambitions of Hillary Rodham Clinton. We also have this. We have an email. We'll do the email in just a moment. And if you'd like to send us one, that address is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. The second hour of our program today, we will be talking about love and Alzheimer's. All right, let's go to an email for Don. Don Van Natta is our guest, and his book is Her Way, The Hopes and Ambitions of Hillary Rodham Clinton. Tony from Appleton writes this. I'd like the guest to comment on the following observation I have heard about the two front-running candidates. Hillary Clinton seems to be a Republican candidate running in Democratic clothing. Rudy Giuliani is a Democratic candidate running in Republican clothing.
Well, it's a pretty astute observation, and one that if Rudy Giuliani is the Republican nominee and Hillary Clinton is the Democratic nominee, I think we're going to hear a lot more of that commentary. And in a way, it's maybe criticism. Certainly, Rudy Giuliani is not a traditional dyed-in-the-wool Republican. With his view of abortion and other issues, and Hillary Clinton with her vote for the Iraq War resolution and some of the other positions that she has taken is not seen as a sort of traditional Democrat. So it really will be, I believe, the 2008 presidential election, no matter who the nominees are, will be an attempt at finding the center. The Democrat, whoever the Democratic nominee is, certainly if it's Hillary Clinton, is not going to want to be seen as a liberal. And the Republican, whoever that is, whether it's Rudy Giuliani or one of the other candidates, Mitt Romney or Fred Thompson, they're not going to want to be seen as a Bush Republican. And so they're going to be trying to carve out a place for themselves in the center and also portray themselves as the best person who can change the direction of the country. Because in every poll that we see, a vast majority of Americans are dissatisfied with the path that the country is taking. Most Americans feel the country's on the wrong track, and so either one of the nominees are going to certainly try to say they're the best qualified
sure.
to put the country on the right track.
Let me ask you to comment, because it's a story that could be a big story. I'm not sure it will. What do you make of – it's interesting that just a couple paragraphs from Scott McClellan's book, which is coming out this spring, were all over cable news last night, that this is the big story, and he hasn't commented, and we don't have the book yet. Could this be a very big story?
Well, it has the potential to be. I noticed that the White House last night is sort of denying the assertion that Scott McClellan makes, that McClellan says that he basically unknowingly passed on false information to the members of the White House press corps, and that the information came from the five highest ranking officials in the administration, the president himself, the vice president, Karl Rove, Scooter Libby, and the president's chief of staff. But the White House last night said that President Bush has not and would not ask anyone to pass on false information, and they were suggesting that the excerpts that have been made public were taken out of context. So it's a little hard to judge whether the accusation that McClellan seems to be making will have legs and will really cause more problems for the White House on this issue. But certainly it seems to have the potential to do so, since he was,
right.
He was the press secretary for so long, and it certainly appears to be a pretty explosive accusation.
What do you make of the way that this was let out to the press? It's kind of weird, isn't it? We got two paragraphs from the book. That's what the publicist gives everybody. The book isn't out yet. What's the strategy here?
Well, the strategy by the publisher is I think pretty obvious, to just whet the appetites of people just enough that everyone will be clamoring come next year
right.
to buy the book.
Right.
And the fact that McClellan did not sort of come forward yesterday and explain further what he meant, I think is all part of that strategy.
Hmm.
I should tell your listeners that the publisher of the book is Public Affairs, which published my first book, a book about presidents and their golf games, called First Off the Tee. So I don't know if that's a conflict or not, but they are a publisher of my first book, who are publishing Scott McClellan's book.
Mm-hmm. Back to phone calls. Wayne is next from Holman. Hi, Wayne. Hi, Wayne. Turn that radio down, Wayne. Well, we'll ask you to turn the radio down. We'll come back to you. Let's go next to Dave from Green Bay. Hi, Dave.
Hi. I think one of the things that's interesting, in the first Bill Clinton campaign, they said, well, you get two for the price of one, and which is a very unusual, and I thought a lot of people thought was highly controversial, to say, well, there's a co-presidency, and they used to talk about that. That was something that irritated a lot of people, because there was a question of legitimacy and so forth. And now, while they're using Bill Clinton, it's ironic that they're not, when you actually have a former sitting president with all the experience, there might be a stronger argument to say, well, you get two for the price of one.
Right, exactly. But it would be co-presidency.
But there's also the question of legitimacy, because, there's a restriction constitutionally to two terms. So, in one way they're damned if they do, and in the other they're damned if they don't. But I think they're far more nuanced now. And if there's a question of experience, you say, well, why would you try and advertise your spouse as a co-president? Well, in the case of a former president, you probably would have the very best of arguments. And of course, that just happened in Argentina, where the former the newly elected president is the wife of the former president. So maybe there's a pattern there. There's one other comment I find interesting about Hillary is. As far as I know, she's the only major candidate to have given a speech about space policy and plans for NASA. And she was somewhat critical about the Bush program to go to the moon and all the money that's being spent on manned space. And she indicated that she would rebalance, I think is the word that she said, the NASA program to include more research on aeronautics to restore the percentage of the budget devoted to science. And also to look more at basic research and innovation. And, to her credit, I think these are very, very important issues for the future of our economy and our country and where we're going. So, I give her some credit for having paid attention to something that probably is not going to draw a huge base of public support, but is still a substantive issue. And she did come out publicly, and no other candidate, I think, has taken the trouble to try and do that. And as kind of a space advocate, and, I certainly reacted positively to that about her campaign. So those are my two comments about.
Thank you. Good comments. They are done.
Well, Dave, on the space issue, Senator Clinton has a very keen interest in NASA and in the space program. When she was a teenager, she wrote a letter to NASA asking if they took women or young girls up into space as astronauts. And so this is something her whole life she's been interested in. And I was also struck by the fact that she made a kind of a major speech and quite a detailed description of what she would do with the space program if she were president. None of the other candidates have done so. On your first point, on the two-for-one point, you're absolutely right that the two-for-one comment in 1992 rubbed a lot of people the wrong way and really hurt Bill Clinton as a candidate. And the Clintons are quite mindful of that, and they are being much more careful and far more nuanced this time, though, as I think you sort of implied, now it would be more of a time to possibly make the argument that in fact it is two for one, but they don't want to do that. They're very careful. They typically say that, and Bill Clinton has said this a number of times. He said it just this past weekend. I saw again. He made this comment that if Hillary's elected president, she is going to be the one making all the decisions. That he will, if asked, give advice. Whatever she asks him to do, he will do. But she's going to be the person who is in charge.
And, well, after all, he owes her, right?
And absolutely, yeah. Absolutely, he owes her. And we go into that in some detail in our book about back in '98 during the Lewinsky scandal, and when Bill Clinton was repeatedly asking the country for forgiveness. He was also repeatedly asking Hillary for forgiveness, and the sort of arrangement they had is that he was going to do everything possible to help her get elected to the Senate, and they did. In fact, in a way, we point out, it's been pointed out elsewhere in other places, including a recent piece in Vanity Fair,
mm-hmm.
more was done by the White House to get Hillary elected Senate than to get Al Gore elected president. And usually a sitting vice president gets all the benefits of the White House when he's running for president. And Al Gore, some of the people around Al Gore feel as if he did not, because there was so much focus in raising money for Hillary Clinton's Senate campaign and making her the junior senator from New York, that it actually hurt Al Gore's chances. And of course, that election was as close as any in American history. And so every little dynamic and every little intangible matters. And there are some people, I know this because I just met with one recently, an Al Gore loyalist, who is still complaining that too much was done for Hillary Clinton's Senate run and not enough was done for Al Gore's presidential run by the Clinton White House.
Which really added to pretty bad blood between the two families.
Absolutely. There was already bad blood because both Al Gore and Hillary Clinton were vying for the sort of attention on the policy front from Bill Clinton through the two terms. But you're absolutely right, Kathleen. There's far more bad blood now than there was even back then.
Yeah. I want to ask you, I've talked about him before because it seems to me as though there's something very genuine about Huckabee. Every time I see him, he just, you know, he's a smart guy. He's a very well-spoken guy. But I was watching him on television last night, and he was talking. It was a direct hit, I think, at Mitt Romney, who's got this very orchestrated campaign. It's hard to know, as we worry about Hillary and who she actually is, we worry about Mitt Romney for the same reason. And he said this kind of simple thing, which I thought was very profound, that when he speaks, he's saying things that he actually believes in. And it seems to me as though the American public are looking for that as well. And I'm wondering if somebody can break through who doesn't have all the focus groups, who doesn't have all this tremendous amount of money, who doesn't have people telling them to say, you got to say this, you got to say that. Are we beyond the point of just somebody who actually is running and says what he believes in that will take to that person? Or are these things so driven by focus groups and money that it's a foregone conclusion that who's ever the best organized and has the most money is gonna win?
Well, history has proven that the person with the most money and with the best organization usually win.
Yeah.
George W. Bush had the most money in 2000. He had the most money in 2004, and he won. Now, there's other reasons why he won, but that was a big factor in both those victories. And going back to 92 and 96, the same thing. The candidate with the most money has an enormous advantage. But your point about the country searching for a candidate who says what he believes, does not give the impression that what he says or what she says is poll-driven,
yes,
or tested by focus groups. There is no question, Kathleen, that there is a great hunger across the country for a candidate like that. And I agree with you that Mike Huckabee, of all of the candidates, probably is doing the best in sort of filling that niche. Now, whether or not he'll be able to break through in Iowa. And Iowa's really the place where any candidate in the second tier has to break through if he has a chance of succeeding. Whether he can do that or not, I don't know. But that authenticity question is really one that, when you talk to a lot of the political strategists, they always bring up. And it really is a big weakness in Senator Clinton's run.
Right.
Because there are so many people that feel as if what she's saying is something that her pollsters told her to say. And, you know, Al Gore had the same problem in 2000. He was overmanaged. There were focus groups.
Right, exactly.
And it probably cost him the election.
Right.
And there was a lot in John Kerry's candidacy,
yep,
that was the same way. And this is something that really strikes fear in the hearts of a lot of Democrats who worry that Senator Clinton, if she's the nominee, is going to have that Gore-Kerry problem with a lot of the sort of independents and people in the center who just don't trust Senator Clinton. You know, I want to quickly tell your listeners that Eleanor Roosevelt, back in 1934, was asked when there would be a woman president of the United States. She was asked this by a young women's rights advocate and lawyer named Lillian Rock. And Eleanor Roosevelt at the time was on a radio program, and she thought about it, and she said that she thought that the country would elect a woman to be president when a majority of the people trusted her and had confidence in her integrity.
Hmm.
And it's amazing that those comments were so prescient when it comes to Hillary Clinton, because I really believe that if she's going to be elected president of the United States, it will be because a majority of the people trust her and have confidence in her integrity. And if she doesn't win, it will be because a majority of people don't trust her, don't have confidence in her integrity. And that's what's so exciting about this election. It's just historic in so many ways.
Oh, it is.
And it's going to be fascinating in the coming year to watch it all unfold.
Exactly. I'm ready to hit the road and just follow everybody and do shows on it all the time. Thanks very much for the call. Let's go to Louis from Wausau. Hi, Louis.
Hello. Backing up to the dynasty question, we have had dynasties in the presidential level, the Adams boys and the Roosevelt boys in the 20th century, and they did pretty well. On other levels, there have been, I just scribbled some names here, Cabot, Lodges, Tafts, Kennedys, Gores, And I conclude from this that the liberal dynasties have done pretty well, and the conservative ones have done us damage. So would you like to comment?
I'm sure he
on that?
Would. Don, we have about a minute left.
Well, that's a good point, and it quite frankly, it's one that that I had not thought of. That there really is a tradition in this country of dynasties, and if you really analyze it carefully, the more conservative or right-leaning dynasties, and obviously you're speaking about the Bushes. Have done quite a bit of damage to the country's reputation, whereas the liberal ones, the Kennedys and some of the others that you mentioned, have done far better. It's a very interesting question, and one that had not occurred to me. And I think your caller is onto something. Mm. And there's it sounds as if there's maybe a great magazine article or even a book in this topic. It's fascinating, and you're absolutely right. And I think. Come next year, if we do have a Clinton-Giuliani showdown, there will be a lot written about this dynasty question, and your caller's point is a very, very smart one.
Yeah, it sure is. Thanks, Louis, so much for the call. Well, Don, you can take comfort in the fact that this conversation will be continued by many over the Thanksgiving feast tomorrow.
That's right, it will be.
I hate to say goodbye to it, but we'll just keep talking among ourselves. Thank you so much for being with us. Please join us again.
I would love to, Kathleen. It's been great to be with you. Thank you so much.
Don Van Natta, our guest, he's an investigative reporter for the New York Times, and his book, co-author of the book Her Way, The Hopes and Ambitions of Hillary Rodham Clinton. Thanks to Peter Donalds for producing the hour, to Rhonda Fanning for on-air production. Thanks, everybody, for your calls. This is the Ideas Network.